genre。
Everyone, and welcome to the Protagonist Podcast, where each week we look at a great character and a great story. I'm Joe Dorowski, and this week we're discussing Data from Star Trek The Next Generation. Joining me for the discussion is producer Andrew. Welcome, Andrew.
Hello.
So we're going to be discussing two episodes, both from the second season of Star Trek The Next Generation. Elementary Dear Data is the third episode from the second season. It was written by Brian Allen Lane and directed by Rob Bowman, and tells the story of Data and Geordi having a holodeck adventure, which always goes great. Anytime someone's getting on the holodeck in Act 1 in a Star Trek The Next Generation episode, you know what the main plot device is going to be.
I'm trying to think of I'm pretty sure I can count on one hand the number of times that's like, yep, and the holodeck was used effectively and nothing went wrong and it did exactly what it was supposed to.
Everyone just relaxed and recharged.
That didn't actually rely on, well, no, really, it's just being a basketball court. Like, if it's acting as a basketball court effectively, then it's fine. And I can think of a couple of examples of that. It gets used for like a Klingon ceremonial setting. I was like, you know what? To be a room with some ambiance works great. But yep. Every time they try to do something more complex.
Let's go have an adventure.
Yeah.
In this case, their adventure is going to be in the world of Sherlock Holmes. And as we've hinted at, it will go wrong. And this episode originally aired on December 5th, 1988. We're also talking about The Measure of a Man, which was the ninth episode of the second season. It was written by Melinda M. Snodgrass and directed by Robert Shearer. And it tells the story of a scientist who wants to take Data apart to try and replicate him, while Picard argues that Data is not merely Starfleet property. And this episode originally aired on February 13th, 1989. Data is played by Brent Spiner in every appearance of Data, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Andrew, do you remember when you first saw these episodes?
Star Trek The Next Generation or these episodes?
I don't know.
Because I mean, Star Trek The Next Generation was on TV when I was a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you and our brother Alex would like record episodes on VHS sometimes.
Yeah.
To watch. So I think that's like my initial memories of TNG. And then there's been, it was in syndication, so it was on TV plenty.
Yeah, it would just
lots
be
of episodes
randomly at 9 o'clock on this channel or 11 mm-hmm. p.m. on that channel.
Yeah. And so especially like when I was on summer vacation as a teenager, it's like, well, it's like 10 o'clock. I know a TNG episode is going to be on. I'll just put it on. You know, if I didn't have something else. And it was every day, you know, so I could get five a week. And sometimes they'd do like back-to-back episodes, so it was like they were really burning through them on syndication at some points. So I saw a good number of Star Trek episodes through that, just syndicated television in the early 2000s. And then on streaming at some point, I watched multiple seasons at a time, but I don't think I've actually seen all of The Next Generation. But I've probably seen these episodes multiple times through those methodologies.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. When we were growing up, when we had a VCR with a few home recorded things as our first options of what we could watch on demand, one thing that we had was a marathon that had aired on the local Fox channel in Virginia of Star Trek, the original series. And so we watched that when we had nothing else to watch because there was not worlds of entertainment at your fingertips. Mm-hmm. It was what 12 VHS tapes do you have over there, you know, until you start to grow that collection more and more and more. And so I was a fan of the original Star Trek series before The Next Generation came on. When that one came on, I wasn't like watching it every week, but it was something I was aware of and would kind of catch episodes here and there. Eventually, while I was a teenager, I did see all of them. Like we have an uncle that had at the time like the Paramount ordered VHS tapes, mm-hmm. you know, series collection of them all. And I think I just would borrow those and burn through all of them at some point. But and, I have not
for the most part, Star Trek The Next Generation is like, it's a model of television that we barely have now. Well, you can really skip episodes, no problem. Like, oh, I didn't see it last week. Doesn't matter. Status quo.
Yeah.
I'm all good.
Everything like, got put back in place at the end of the last episode.
Very few two-parters. And
yeah, at the most, toys were put back in the box at the end.
At most, it's a two-parter.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we like, you cannot do that with as many shows anymore.
No, this was really even the last of the Star Trek series that did that, because when Deep Space Nine is going to become the next Star Trek series after this, that one becomes heavily serialized and, a continuing narrative that you need to be following season long and then series long ebbs and flows of characters and mythology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is one of the final shows that you would really think of with that model. Cause mm-hmm. like just a few years later, you're getting stuff like The West Wing.
Yeah,
which is like, yeah, you probably don't skip episodes of The West Wing.
Yeah, I mean, you start to see it with sitcoms in the 80s with Cheers, but then that becomes the model in the 90s with broadcast sitcoms. But this is a syndicated TV show, which had a very different model. And syndication was still leaning on the every episode needs to just be able to be dropped in, wherever it could be. While broadcast television was heading into like long-term will they won't they storylines on sitcoms and West Wing style season-long
shows like Lost you can't skip mm-hmm. episodes of Lost.
Yeah, I mean, that'll be a little later, but yeah, that's definitely where we're heading. But syndication was still at this point what you're describing of every episode is a complete standalone,
which is
the tradition of the original Star Trek series, absolutely, even though that was on broadcast television then.
And in many ways, it is great. It is so nice to be like, okay, well, we're binging it. And then you go away for 3 months and you don't need a backup.
Mm-hmm.
You're just like, no, yeah. Just pick up where I was. Like, it's still, we're good.
Yeah. So the original Star Trek TV show aired 3 seasons between 1966 and 69. That's our classic Kirk and Spock and McCoy. That was created by Gene Roddenberry. And then there was an animated spinoff that aired 22 episodes in 1973. And then that was the end of the franchise until 1979, when there was a film with the original cast returning, in part because of the success of a little film called Star Wars. Paramount looked around and said, do we have anything that we could put out there to try and ride some of this wave?
And it is a stretch to call those comparable waves.
People always say
they're not similar.
No, well, like Star Wars is definitely a space opera and also the blend of sci-fi and fantasy. Well, mm-hmm. But just very openly, we have knights and magic swords and
it
magicians.
Star Wars is inherently like adventure coded.
Yeah, and Star Trek often gets called hard sci-fi. It is not hard sci-fi.
No, but it's a different kind of adventure in space than Star Wars.
Mm-hmm. The number of godlike beings with magic powers that they run into just quickly moves Star Trek out of hard sci-fi.
You'd think more of them would just spend time interacting with each other instead of interacting with the Enterprise.
They have a fascination with Kirk and Picard. film with the original cast returning led to a film series that ran through the 1980s. The sixth film came out in 1991, having had at that point a decade-long film franchise and ongoing fan interest in the Star Trek franchise. Paramount asked Gene Roddenberry to create a new Star Trek TV show, and he decided to create a series that was set a century after the original series, which at that time was just called Star Trek. Now it's usually called Star Trek TOS, standing for the original series. Obviously, it wouldn't have been called that when it was airing. But even on like Paramount Plus, I think it's labeled as Star Trek, the original series.
Yeah.
That's how you find it. So he's going to have a new crew, new, more advanced version of the Enterprise, a century of technology advancements, as well as, a few decades of TV technology advancements. And they are going to create Star Trek The Next Generation. And that's going to be so successful that then they will create Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which is going to run 7 series between 1990 seasons between 1993 and 99. Star Trek Voyager, which is going to have 7 seasons between 1995 and 2001. And those are more or less in the same era as Star Trek The Next Generation, mm-hmm. And the Star Trek Next Generation crew is going to sometimes show up on some of these other Star Trek things, but also have their own four film series that's going to go from 94 to 2002. And I'm just going to say that's where I'm going to end my history of the Star Trek franchise, because I do not know everything that has happened.
How to talk about where we're at now.
With Paramount Plus, Paramount Plus decided a huge part of our brand identity is Star Trek. So we're just going to churn out a whole lot of Star Trek. So since 2020,
I think there's a new episode of Star Trek every week of some kind, if not more than
series. There's series set in multiple different eras of Star Trek history at this point.
And I think technically timelines.
There's also the separate timeline from the J.J. Abrams films. Mm-hmm. But I don't think the TV shows are set in that timeline. I think they're set
I think some of them predate the split, and some of them are after the split. And so
we are in the deep end, and I can't go in these waters. Just
thinking. But yeah, I do not fully know 100% where Star Trek is at and what fits in where.
Just know, if you're a fan of Star Trek, there's a lot of it being produced right now on Paramount Plus.
You probably don't need us to tell you that.
Yeah. And there's specifically for this, there was a Star Trek Picard TV series that premiered in 2020 and has three seasons. And that has a whole bunch of Star Trek Next Generation crew that return to it. So Star Trek The Next Generation aired in syndication, which means it does not have a network that is paying for it. It's not there's no single network that says, hey, this is we're going to air it on this time, at this time. On this day of the week or anything like that. It's channels can any purchase local channel can purchase the rights to air it. And usually so traditionally, and all this may be a little different now, but traditionally like your NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, they would have their primetime block of television. Then they would have their late night local news. And then after that, the station would air whatever it wanted that they thought would do well in that market. So the station manager says, in this market, Star Trek's always done well. We're going to license Star Trek. Someone else may say, in this market, you know, Simpsons reruns are hot. We're going to do Simpsons. Someone else might say Seinfeld reruns are what we're going to show. You know, it's they just buy from the catalog of syndicated stuff that's out there, whether it's reruns or original shows that don't have a specific network home.
And at the time, it was actually locally based.
Yeah.
Within a few years, it became like, no, there's just 5,000 channels that everyone has access to.
Yes, but depending on where you lived, Star Trek The Next Generation would air at a different time and a different day. Sometimes it might be Saturday afternoons.
And a different channel, maybe.
Friday evenings, yeah. Despite this, it was extremely popular, frequently rating above network shows. There are seasons of Star Trek The Next Generation where the overall average was above 10 million viewers. That would be the most watched broadcast television show today. Mm-hmm. That would dwarf NCIS, I think, is the most popular TV show in terms of Nielsen ratings, and it's averaging 8 million.
It's hard to compare with streaming numbers and everything now. So, I don't know.
Everything is so fractured.
I don't know how many people watched Succession last year,
mm-hmm.
but that was like the big one on streaming.
Or even like with NCIS, that's talking about like when NCIS airs, how many people are watching that when it hits a streamer, you know, 3 months later or anything like that. Like those numbers aren't being very well, presented to us, to the public. The finale of Star Trek: The Next Generation would have over 30 million viewers. And this was a hit show.
Huge.
Yeah. Specifically, we're talking about these two episodes that come fairly early on in the run of the show. Elementary Dear Data was nominated for two Emmys. Both are for the design. So set design and costume design. And this is somewhat of a fan favorite episode. As I was poking around, I saw it on a lot of lists of like the 10 best episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation. Elementary Dear Data is on the list, usually not the top, but it's one of those that's memorable. And just because of the title and the instant hook of like, oh, the Sherlock episode, everyone kind of knows this episode if you've watched Star Trek The Next Generation. It's very memorable.
And through like the first half of season two, the first season and a half of The Next Generation is not typically like super fondly looked on. I'd say
it's a bit uneven.
Yeah. But picking up in the second half of season two and moving forward, you're like, okay, this is like pretty reliable. I know what I'm getting and what I'm getting is pretty good. And so these are both from not quite that point. I've heard some people say like, yeah, you can really skip most of the first two seasons. Do watch Measure of a Man. Like, definitely yes. Watch Measure of a Man.
Measure of a Man is often called the first great episode of the series. Mm-hmm. We're talking about one that comes before that's fun and memorable, but Measure of a Man is... I think that was in almost all of the top 10 lists. Sometimes it's at the top of all of Star Trek history. This is one of the best episodes that has ever been made for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I think it does. It is kind of like a bellwether or a turning point for the series.
Yeah. But Elementary Dear Data is not a bad episode.
No. And there's a surprising amount of overlap between these two, actually, when we talk about like the big ideas. Mm. So The Measure of a Man was a spec script that was written by Snodgrass that was moved into production in part because there was a writer's strike in 1988 and they were short on scripts. But because of the strength of this script, Snodgrass is going to become a staff writer. And she's like a known entity in sci-fi writing. Both her name is very notable. So when you see it, you know, it doesn't blend in. But also there's just, this was her first spec script. I mean, come on.
Did she? So what other
amazing bit of writing?
Are there like other notable episodes where she was the main writer?
Let me go look that up. I think I had we were supposed to record this about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And then we had to pause. And so I've lost like the freshness of some of the trivia that I had looked up at that point.
But it, like, this has a tone that when you watch later episodes of The Next Generation, you're like, yes, this feels like what I am watching this show for.
Yes. She's going to go on and work on scripts for The Outer Limits reboot at the time, Sequest, The Profiler. She's a producer on that. For Star Trek Next Generation, she wrote Pen Pals, Up the Long Ladder, The Ensigns of Command, and High Ground.
Mm-hmm. I know Pen Pals for sure is a data-centric episode, and I'd say similar to this in it's dealing very philosophically with what happens when you have like advanced technology and everything.
Yeah, she's also written a Star Trek novel and a whole bunch of other short stories and novels, some of which like Wild Cards is a popular fantasy series George R. R. Martin's involved in. She was a writer on that. Books, it was a book series with multiple authors that had a whole bunch of like big names in sci-fi and fantasy that came and worked on the same series, and so she was in that. Let's see, where was I in our trivia?
So we're talking about Snodgrass writing the episode spec script.
And also, so besides this episode being important because it's just really good, it also features the first instance of something that's going to become something of a staple. This is the first time you see the Next Generation crew playing a poker game together.
Mm. I thought you were going to say this is the first like courtroom episode, which is also something that you see multiple times, but this might not be the first one.
And then the last bit of trivia for the Blu-ray release of the series of The Next Generation, Paramount had included a special edition of Measure of a Man, which had an extra 13 minutes edited into the episode that they shot, that they had to trim. At that point, like, you know, you're filming too much if you have a full 13 minutes.
That's multiple scenes, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it has to be. I've not seen that version. Like when I pulled it up on Paramount Plus, it was just the regular version, and maybe there's like a place to find special features where the longer version is streaming, but that's out there if you're a huge fan.
Huh.
All right, before we move on to the summaries of these two episodes, we want to thank all of you for downloading this episode and listening. We especially want to thank those of you who support us on Patreon. If you'd like to support us financially, we invite you to go to patreon.com/protagonist and support our show with at least $1 per month. All supporters on Patreon at any level receive access to our monthly quick casts, which are shorter episodes in which we talk about the media that we are consuming but not yet covering as full episodes of this podcast. And all patrons who support us with $5 per month or more get to choose a topic for us to discuss. Now, more is always an option, everyone. It really is. All right. Here is the plot summary of Elementary Dear Data. The Enterprise is just hanging out, waiting at a rendezvous point. So Geordi wants to take
Data. They arrived to the somewhere early.
Yep. They got there early. That's the inciting incident, is we're early.
Therefore, there's downtime.
Yep. So Geordi's going to take Data to the holodeck for a fun Sherlock Holmes adventure. Data will be Holmes. Geordi will be Watson. But they quickly realize, well, Geordi realizes, because Data knows all of the Arthur Conan Doyle Sherlock Holmes stories, he solves the mystery as soon as he sees which person has walked into the office. he knows if it's that name, this is the story. I've solved it. So Geordi eventually shuts down the program and leaves.
Did you already establish that Data is an android and therefore has a perfect memory and superhuman strength? And
you know, I think I might not. We might not say that at the point.
We may have taken that for granted.
Yes, Data is an android with a positronic brain. That's going to be a key part of the next episode we talk about. He's the most advanced android that the universe has ever seen in the world of Star Trek. And he's played by Brent Spiner with just, I don't know how he does this. It's amazing what Brent Spiner does as Data. I think this is a really underrated performance in television. That he does it for 7 years.
He does it for so long. So reliably.
Yeah. Yes. And there's some episodes where he's got to play like an evil version. He has a brother named Lore that's an evil android. And then he also plays the creator. So there's one episode where he's playing three characters at once. It's crazy. Anyway, Geordi leaves because it's not really fun to try and do a mystery when Data's going to solve it the instant he has a clue. Later, Geordi explains to Data the mystery, or the joy of a mystery, is solving the unknown. Now, Dr. Pulaski, who is the worst, overhears.
Particularly in regards to Data. Specifically, yes. With Data in mind, she is... there's moments where Pulaski is a main character in the story, but her introduction into the crew is... I am negative and I don't trust Data as a person. I treat him as a machine.
Yeah. Yeah. So in season one, there was Dr. Crusher. Then season two, they change up a whole bunch of things about the series because season one is, as we noted, fairly rough. And one of the things they did was they threw out Crusher and brought in Dr. Pulaski. To me, this was a terrible misstep.
And she only lasts like the one season.
Yeah. And then Dr. Crusher comes back. So I was like, remember her. She was better.
Dr. Pulaski does not fit with the vibe of the crew.
No, I don't think that's immediately the actress. It's just the way she gets written, and the overall feel. Like it just comes off wrong, and particularly when we're starting to explore Data a lot more in the second season, and she is so antagonistic towards Data, it makes you not like her. Like we're not rooting for her. Mm-hmm. Anyway, she overhears this conversation, and she goes and argues that Data could not solve a mystery he didn't already have all the information for in his system. All he does is respond to what's already been downloaded into him. They all decide that they're going to go to the holodeck and have the computer devise a brand new Sherlock Holmes mystery. However, Data immediately solves this one because it has elements of several Sherlock Holmes stories that have been stitched together, and he just sees the pieces and says what's happening. So then Geordi instructs the computer to create an adversary capable of defeating Data. Gotta be careful with what you say in the holodeck, Geordi.
Oh, man.
He doesn't say Sherlock Holmes.
The holodeck is just too dangerous. Surely there are countless deaths of unnamed crew members who have said something wrong.
Some careless slip of the tongue in the holodeck, just and plummeting to their death, and the safety features got turned off because they didn't know they were asking for that off. Yeah, whatever. So in this new mystery, Dr. Pulaski is kidnapped, and Data and Geordi cannot find her. They soon learn that Moriarty is behind it, but this Moriarty has become aware that he is on something like a starship. He's communicating with a ship computer and has even drawn a sketch of the Enterprise. When Geordi and Data have a conversation with him and realize, oh, this is not good. they try to stop the program, and they realize that Moriarty has gained enough control over the ship's computer to make it impossible to turn off the holodeck program. Data and Geordi leave the holodeck to tell Captain Picard what has happened. They all realize Geordi didn't say to create an antagonist that could defeat Sherlock Holmes, but one that could defeat Data. Picard goes into the holodeck to talk with Moriarty, who has gained more self-awareness that he is a computer program, but one that is evolving. Picard explains that they do not have the technology to make a holodeck program into actual matter, but if they ever do, they will bring Moriarty back and allow him an independent form. With this promise, Moriarty allows the program to be discontinued, and they turn off the holodeck. The end.
And they just presumably pull out a little USB and tuck him away in someone's desk drawer.
Yeah. Oh, let's bring this back. Maybe when the Voyager has going to have a holodeck doctor, they'll say, oh, you know what? We could do that.
We do have, this self-aware artificial intelligence. I mean, okay. So we kind of gloss past it, but This means that they have achieved the artificial intelligence singularity, where a computer program is capable of creating a computer program that is self-aware.
Which means like, that could occur
infinitely. Like the fact that he controls the holodeck computer presumes that he advances beyond the holodeck computer.
I mean, part of this is like, are they talking to the Enterprise computer that has been given Foreman Moriarty in some way?
Yeah.
Or did the we'll come back to this. Let's go through Measure of a Man.
He's not self-aware as the Enterprise. He's self-aware as
Moriarty,
a computer program on the Enterprise.
Yeah, that's
anyway.
True. But you're right. The Enterprise computer is capable of creating that. Yeah.
Is capable of creating a self-sufficient, self-aware program that is independent of itself.
Yeah. All right. The Measure of a Man. A Starfleet cyberneticist named Bruce Maddox. You know how I said Pulaski was the worst.
This guy's maybe a little worse.
Yeah. He wants to study Data in order to be able to recreate his positronic brain, which is a scientific achievement that no one has ever come close to matching. Data was created by Dr. Noonien Singh, if I'm pulling some very old Star Trek trivia from my brain. I haven't gone back and watched Star Trek.
It might be Noonien Singh.
In decades? Singh? Okay. This made me want to go back and watch Star Trek just to go do these episodes. But to do this, Bruce Maddox would dismantle Data entirely, like down to everything's spread out on the table. Data does not want to be taken apart, in particular because he does not believe that Maddox has the skill to safely preserve Data's computer program and restore him to his present state. Maddox goes to a superior officer above Picard to argue that Data must comply with the study, and Data is ordered to go with Maddox. Picard tells Data to resign from Starfleet to get out of this, because basically then you don't have to follow Starfleet orders, which Data does. However, the Starfleet judge advocate general for the sector, it's a JAG officer, right?
Yeah.
Because it's all Navy nerd terminology here, argues that Data is not a sentient being who can resign, but rather Data is a piece of technology that belongs to Starfleet. Picard appeals this ruling, and the judge agrees to a formal hearing on the matter. Picard will represent Data, and the next ranking officer, William Riker, is ordered to represent Maddox. Riker does not want to do this. He does not agree with Maddox. He thinks it's unethical to take Data apart, but he is ordered to present the strongest legal argument possible for Maddox's position. In court, Riker presents Data as a machine, no more than the sum of parts made by his creator. He asks Data to remove his arm, which Data does, and he also uses Data's off switch to shut the android down entirely. Picard, he's going to have a conversation with Guinan, Whoopi Goldberg. Space Whoopi Goldberg, that I don't put
who
in
is who is a great addition in season two.
Yes. There is maybe a little bit of the magical Negro about about the Guinan character. Suda is about to start trying to describe her.
Yes.
But she does offer Picard advice that he needs to hear that does begin to equate the plan to create essentially an infinite number of Datas to serve Star Trek with slavery, and that triggers Picard, you know, in Picard's mind some ways to start talking through this. So Picard is going to present his case in a more metaphysical way, arguing that Data is clearly intelligent and self-aware, and the court does not have a system in place of measuring consciousness. And therefore Data should be allowed the right to choose because he is a self-aware being. In the end, the judge rules that Data does have the right to choose. Data chooses to remain a Starfleet officer, but refuses to be studied by Maddox. After the hearing, he encourages Maddox to continue his work, and when he reaches a point that Data is comfortable with, he will agree to further studies. The end.
I have discovered why Data's creator's name is difficult.
Why is it?
Data was created by Dr. Noonien Singh. But that is really easy to confuse with Khan Noonien Singh.
Oh, that's what it is. That's what I was. I was crossing the streams
from the second movie with the original cast. And it does seem to be that there's lots of speculation about relationships and connections between the Noonien Singh family and the Noonien Singh family.
Right. Okay. I was definitely crossing over different bits of Star Trek trivia from my from my memory. All right, these episodes are going to come out pretty close to one another. Well, like I said, one comes out.
Like two months.
Yeah, December 5th, 1988, and then February 13th, 1989. And I did not think of suggesting we do these because of the thematic similarity between them. Well, similarity slash contrast between them, which we'll delve into. Mm-hmm. I did it because I remembered you mentioning that you'd recently watched Measure of a Man. I'm like, oh, that is a good one. Like, I remember that from like 20 years ago. So it's definitely worth doing on the podcast.
And so you just wanted something else that was data focused.
I wanted another data focused episode. And also, I had been teaching a unit about adaptations of Sherlock Holmes in a class.
Ah, so it was on your mind.
We had mentioned this episode, and I showed a few minutes of it, in particular because we were talking about the fact that in the Sherlock Holmes canon, Moriarty is not a supervillain that appears frequently. He appears in one short story and gets referenced like two other times. Mm-hmm. But in all adaptations of Sherlock Holmes, you have to include Moriarty.
He is the great villain.
Yes. The constant thorn in Sherlock Holmes' side. And so I remembered, I'm like, oh, there's a Star Trek episode where Data is Sherlock Holmes and he fights Moriarty. Of course, like it has to be Moriarty. So we showed a few minutes of this for that discussion.
I'm picturing like the metatextual concept of Moriarty, seeing mm-hmm. what's happening. Like, it was one time. Like, what have you done to me?
You want to know the other recurring Sherlock Holmes character in all adaptations that's the same situation?
Is it
Irene Adler?
One appearance. It's either Adler or Lestrade.
Yeah, Lestrade is more frequent in the original stories, but Irene Adler is in one Arthur Conan Doyle short story. And yet, if you're going to do Sherlock Holmes adaptations, who are you casting as Irene Adler?
There must be someone.
Yes. So then I was like, oh, we'll do that. And then I watched the two episodes back to back. I'm like, they're talking about the same things, but reaching some very different conclusions.
Yes.
On these.
And like, it certainly doesn't feel like one conclusion informed the other conclusion.
All right, so let's dig into that. The elementary Dear Data has an emerging consciousness that is not biological.
Yes.
That
intelligent? Self-aware?
Intelligent? Self-aware. Yes, that's a key part. But seems to be potentially harming the Enterprise and its mission because it won't release control of the Enterprise computer. Like, it's getting more and more control of the Enterprise computer, and that's raising red flags everywhere. So we are going to do
I really enjoy mental gymnastics to
convince him to stand down, essentially.
Yes. I enjoy where he develops a way to like pull a lever to make the entire Enterprise shake.
Yes, it's like steampunk steering of the Enterprise.
I need to throw one
bit of trivia about this episode that does, mm-hmm. anytime you look up information about it, it bothers people. Moriarty draws a sketch of the Enterprise and shows it to Data and Geordi and says, like, I think I'm on something that looks like this, and it's a sketch of the Enterprise. And they take that out with them. Things that are made in the holodeck are not supposed to be able to leave the holodeck.
And so that paper should not be able to be pulled
out. That paper should not have left the holodeck. Mm.
That's why
they are always walking through the corridors dressed in the costumes as they're about to go into the holodeck.
Right, because it... Okay, though, that makes sense.
Couldn't they just get dressed in the holodeck? Wouldn't that be easier?
Then they need, like, a changing room.
Right, that's true. But also, it's more fun to see people dressed like Sherlock Holmes wandering through.
Mm-hmm. It is much more fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think one thing with elementary is... it's much less clear what Moriarty is. I mean, we had like a mini debate about it. Like, is he just part of like the holodeck computer? Is he interfacing with the ship's computer outright? I don't know how closely related the holodeck computer and the main computer, like, you know, the functional steering computer are. Clearly there's connection points, but I don't know if they're the same computer.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, like, where does he fit into that? Like, where is his consciousness in the grand scheme of the ship? Because they say, like, mm-hmm. well, you can't leave the holodeck. It's like, yeah, but if he's, like, a conscious program, couldn't he distribute throughout any computer system?
Or, you know, like get a mini projector and have him walk around.
Yes. You know, is it viable to do the holographic doctor from Voyager? with him,
yeah,
you know, and not too many years in the future. And so I think it's kind of confusing because also, yeah, he's like, he has to go through a holodeck mechanical process to exert influence on the Enterprise.
Yeah.
You know, like he's got to pull a lever. It's like, okay, so he's not like in the computer. He is just in the holodeck.
Mm-hmm.
But what is he?
Yeah. Is he just this software? Right. Mm-hmm. And is that why we see like such a different attitude being taken between Data in the next episode that we're going to
see? Or is he just like a file inside the software?
Yeah. And do we need something tactile and independent like Data's body besides whatever computer network is running his positronic brain that makes you see Data as an individual that must be preserved and must have his rights argued for in the court of law? Whereas Picard is willing to just go in and logic Moriarty to shutting down with a wink, wink, we'll bring you back sometime. As far as I know, Moriarty has never reappeared in Star Trek.
I don't think he comes back ever.
I mean, that feels like they might have done like one of the like novel number 127 in the 1990s Star Trek The Next Generation novel series might have a Moriarty appearance.
Probably a novel has him, but I don't think he's in any episodes.
Yeah, he didn't come back for the Picard series. Like, oh, Moriarty, I kept my promise. you're back. Bet the audience didn't see this one coming.
Yeah, and I think also with like the holodeck stuff, everything is supposed to be an illusion, and so part of me wonders, okay, is this an illusion of sentience that the holodeck is creating, and the holodeck is manipulating the Enterprise because its job is to like mess with Data right now.
Right. So,
and like, so it's is he actually
taking control of a lever that will shake the whole Enterprise, or is this
just holodeck computer just pretending through Moriarty or imitating sentience? Is like, okay, well, what if you were presented with a sentient computer program? How would you deal with that? And until it's satisfied. And I kind of like that termination of it.
Mm hmm. I feel okay with that too, particularly in contrast with what the discussion we're about to have about Measure of a Man, where it feels like Picard has turned a 180 on AI sentience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that's going to be...
No, he's not shutting down Moriarty and saying you are only a computer program. He does say we don't have the technology to keep you running, essentially. Mm-hmm. And Data clearly does have the technology to be kept running. So there is a difference there.
But, you know, if we go with the, okay, it's actually the holodeck pretending this scenario, then all Picard had to do was get to that point of a logical argument to, like, end the program and say, like, okay, this is how you would defeat such an adversary.
Now, I believe the premise of the holodeck is that nothing from the holodeck should affect the rest of the ship. So we could say, well, that can't be the case. However, there is also every other holodeck themed episode that would make us say that the holodeck does affect the rest of the ship.
People get shot with bullets in the holodeck. Yeah. And another part of like the conclusion of this one, and this is where it does feel a little Deus Ex Machina to have Picard come in and resolve everything. At the end of this episode, it's like, okay, Picard comes in, he solves it, he has like one philosophical conversation, and all the danger is gone. It's like, oh, well, this was supposed to be a Data episode.
And I think it would have been better writing and also more interesting to have Data as an artificial creation, an android, be the one to have a conversation with Moriarty.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, one part of their conclusion is they announce to the computer that Data is defeated. You know, like, or they announced to Moriarty, but I'm going to say like the computer is in control of all of this. And so like part of the statement is like, clearly Data is not smart enough to like resolve all the issues, but also this has gotten bigger than the Sherlock Holmes mystery. I'm not sure this episode like totally holds up when you try to like pick at exactly what's going on.
But yeah, it does, I think this but it does more have of...
like the feel of Star Trek.
Yeah, and it's fun. It absolutely is fun, and I'm actually the impressed costumes with the are level really fun. Of set design and the costumes that they do. I understand why it was nominated for those awards. And if you don't stop to kind of take it all apart and kind of think through the ramifications of everything, it is very easy to just move on to the next episode because this is never going to be mentioned again, right? Like there's an Moriarty subroutine that they're worried is going to flare up in the computer, you know, in season five or anything like that.
And I think like the work and commitment that it would take to clear all of that up, like it is fine that they did not spend that time and effort. Like it would have taken a lot to make this a great episode.
Right. And so in the end, this one becomes more of a fun episode, whereas Measure of a Man is often considered a great episode. Mm-hmm. So in that,
and, but it started that way, you know, this one you would have to take from fun to great, and it would take some doing. And then if you're going to do that, then you have to commit to Moriarty coming back in some form or really clearly saying, oh, it was just the computer pretending to be sentient.
Mm-hmm. And like some of these ambiguities that we're left with at the end would have to be really explicitly cleared up. And the fact
it's less satisfying if you pick one of those lanes, it's kind of less satisfying.
And it doesn't bother me that they didn't clear it up because of what my expectations were for a Star Trek The Next Generation episode and what the audience was looking for. Like, it's fine. This is a fun episode. It's the Sherlock episode. And sometimes that's good to have like a serviceable, fun episode that isn't trying to say something profound. Though it is kind of interesting that like this is 1988 and sci-fi is always doing this where they're like thinking about questions that now 30 years later we're having to say, you know, about this AI stuff.
A little bit. we do have like, to say a little bit. Okay, but for real, what do you think we should do?
We're at the point of like so all the generative AI debates and it crossing over into art and creation, like obviously I think there's some pretty clear lines that we can draw around a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we're on the cusp of AI
self-awareness and the AI singularity.
Yeah, that Moriarty represents. But we're certainly further along than we were in 1988 when they were speculating about all this for a fun side adventure, you know, Sherlock Holmes episode of Star Trek. Mm-hmm. So we probably do need to be thinking about it. Do you have a take?
My preferred reading of this is that it was the computer pretending to be sentient and it did not actually develop the AI singularity.
Okay. Yeah,
that's and my preferred take right the cusp now. Of I would rather not.
With our generative chat GTP stuff, we're not on the cusp of creating an AI.
like the true science fiction artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have something that can help generate some prompts and you know, gather some concepts from the internet and organize them.
But, which is actually a good segue, because that's what Dr. Pulaski is going to say Data is. That all he is a series of inputs and outputs, and he's
organizing
an input into him. But he's not
creative
to be creative in a way. And she says that's you know, the limitation on her ability to recognize him as an individual and not as just a computer, right? As talking to the ship's computer.
Hmm.
And I mean, you can go. If you want to like excise all of the idea of like a soul, like there are some arguments that that's basically what humans are. Like we're a series of, you know, stimulus and response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Theoretically, you could dig through the electrical impulses and identify cause and effect for everything that occurs in our brains and everything that occurs in our actions.
Right. But we don't want to think about ourselves that way. But Pulaski is definitely comfortable thinking about Data that way. All right, let's talk a little bit about Measure of a Man. We got this new antagonist, Maddox. They might as well just inserted Pulaski in this role if they wanted. and this episode, it's kind of interesting because it's so famous as a Star Trek The Next Generation episode. I'd say probably the next most famous or the one that's maybe a little more famous is the best of both worlds, which is the Borg episode where Picard gets, you know, becomes a Borg. And that one is like action and twists and
like
you know,
season
explosions.
A season ending cliffhanger.
A cliffhanger that you're gonna have to wait 5 months for it to be resolved.
I was so glad when I watched that I only had to wait 2 minutes while it loaded.
Well, it loaded the next one. And this one has no action. It is a courtroom drama in one set. I don't know if they were like budget constraints or if they were just happy with the script. So like, we don't need like there's no action that happens in this episode.
And like a lot of the normal characters aren't in this episode. Like it is very limited.
Yeah. And yet this one is beloved because it sticks the like the thematic landing so well. Mm-hmm. So I think Elementary Dear Data is beloved because it's a fun concept and it's kind of cool to, yeah, it's super memorable to have like the Sherlock Holmes episode. But when we start to kind of like think through maybe some of the themes or does it hold up when, yeah, as far as like, is it saying anything? It's like, not as much. This one says, all we want to do is think about sci-fi questions that maybe are going to have a real world application at some point.
Yeah. Could consider this one in that hard sci-fi kind of territory. Like this is very like Isaac Asimov.
Yeah.
You know, like robotic.
What are our rules for robots? How as a society are we going to function when there are robots walking around?
Mm-hmm.
It does some interesting things. The Riker being forced to be the point of view.
Yeah, to be the accuser.
Right.
Basically.
I don't know that there's enough narrative reason that we that feels like it's been given for that to happen, other than we got Jonathan Frakes on contract and he didn't do a whole lot last episode, so
I think there's like a rational in world reason to say like, okay, here's the dynamic. We don't have a full court system. You're going to be the defendant. You're going to be the, you know, the advocate and you're going to be the prosecutor. That's the legal term. And so like in universe, they do enough with it. I think Jonathan Frakes does a pretty good job with his role in this episode. There's a moment where because they say like, if you don't do a good job, then Data's done for. Like you really do have to make the effort and argue this properly. Like that is your duty. And so there's a scene where he's like studying Data to try and find an argument, and he realizes something that is going to work. And then he also realizes, I don't want this to work, but I have to, like, I figured something out. It helps me make my point. I don't want to make my point, but I'm stuck with this. Mm. Like, and he does that all like face acting, you know, he doesn't say anything. He's just looking at a screen and having like a realization. This helps prove my point. I don't actually believe in my point. I wish that I hadn't found this.
And I think Frakes does a fine job of playing the conflict, of playing both, you know, the assertiveness when he needs to be assertive when he's making his case, but also we as an audience see that he wishes he wasn't doing this so well, but also he knows he's doing it well. Like he knows he found the right argument. It's not going to be foolproof because he's going up against Picard. And also we need Data around for the next episode. So we know how this is going to end as an audience, but it's kind of interesting to see it all play out. And for the somewhat like forced premise that he has to be the prosecutor, I think Jonathan Frakes does a good job, you know, with that, in terms of his acting.
They do pull it in again at the end when everyone's celebrating that Data gets to stay on the Enterprise and everything. He doesn't feel like he can be part of that celebration, and Data talks to him and Data thanks him for doing his duty, not just as like as a member of Starfleet, but he's like, you were being my friend by doing what you needed to try, like you had to do this to help me. You know, if you hadn't done something that was challenging for you, then I wouldn't still be here. And Data has like a thing where he says like, the fact that you would hurt yourself to help me shows that you're my friend. And I can see that. And that's like the button on the whole thing. It's like, man, Data does get what it means to like be human.
Yeah, and I mean that's the long term arc for Data. You know, as we're saying, like this one's much more episodic. Like there is this quest of Data to understand emotion, to understand humanity more. Like that's, like his one of his defining characteristics, right? Is that yes, he's a machine, but he's trying to understand more. And like you said, that little moment at the end of empathy for Riker or grace towards Riker. When Riker's feeling very down, like it is a very human moment that seems to be outside of logic and reason.
But also like it's like very sensitive and emotional, but it's also in a way that, oh, a human might not always be able to pull that off because they would be hurt. And so it's like, it's like the perfect combination of this like logical, like Data can understand it and understand what it should mean for him emotionally, even if it doesn't technically mean that for him emotionally. Does that make sense? Like it's a complex way where it's like, well, a person might feel awkward around Riker after that, but Data doesn't feel awkward because he doesn't have the emotional side of that. But he can say, I understand what these emotions should mean if you followed the emotions logically, which is a weird way to describe it. But Data understands like, oh, if you follow emotions logically, then this is the outcome that there should be. And so he says like, I know that you're my good friend.
Yeah, basically. And what you were doing was also going to lead to the best outcome for me, because if you had not done your job well, the judge would have just called it.
Mm-hmm. And so I really like that scene at the end between Data and Riker. And I think that's like a very well written concept in this episode about Data and about his humanity, is to have him be the one to express like, I understand that you're my friend, which is like the most human thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because like we're praising some of these performances, like outside of Patrick Stewart, like most of the actors from Star Trek Restoration didn't have, you know, huge careers that's sprawled outside of it. Patrick Stewart, obviously very well respected actor, mm-hmm. but I think Brent Spiner is doing a really, really good job with this. And, you know, Jonathan Frakes, like he does a great job with what he's given to work with mm-hmm. in this. And it's a role that I feel is like a little awkward, maybe a little forced, but he does a great job of making it work. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't like really bother me when I'm watching it. It's only when I'm writing a summary. I'm like, really, why did they make Riker do that? You know, yeah. I start to, you know, ask those kinds of questions, but his performance is good enough. I don't worry about it when I'm watching the mm-hmm. episode.
Maddox, great villain.
Yeah.
His Star Trek villain performance down.
Yeah, just that like a little sheen of sliminess over all of his motivations.
mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. You were going to talk about Picard and his role in the episode.
So I think the most interesting moment of the episode is his conversation with Guinan, where like he's being forced to think about if I'm viewing Data as an individual who happens to be part technology, what happens when I allow it? You know, a lot of versions of this, and it's not trying to do the one-to-one. Like sometimes Star Trek can make you feel just a little like the alien races are clearly a stand-in for some group on mm-hmm. Earth. I'm like, it's a little iffy. Like you got a good noble heart, but sometimes it feels just a little iffy how it's being done. And I think they avoid like trying to say like this is a stand-in for all prejudice on Earth, or you know, for a specific oppressed group or a specific group that was enslaved historically on Earth, with doing this kind of metaphorical thinking about it. Instead, it just kind of becomes this idea about humans as oppressors, you know, just in general, right? Mm-hmm. And Jean-Luc Picard has instant discomfort with that. That is going to give him kind of this philosophical avenue to start thinking through Data's rights and Data's self-awareness, mm-hmm. his individuality. And that is, you know, he's not going to, when you say like he's going to have kind of a metaphysical argument, it doesn't become like Data has a soul. They don't even touch on that, really.
It is, in this. You know, if we do mass produce Data, what are we going to use them for? And is that like what precedent are we setting for what many Datas could have in terms of rights? Or
in particular, I think it was self-autonomy. The episode, like it was so good in the episode that they set up like Data is willing to resign from Starfleet to avoid this outcome. Like Data mm-hmm. has a choice. Data's you know, will follow orders, but
because he's part of Starfleet.
Because he's part of Starfleet, but if I really don't want to be taken apart, so I'm willing to resign from Starfleet to avoid that. That's like this level of
self-preservation.
Yes, self-preservation and agency that the you know, Enterprise computer doesn't possess.
Mm-hmm.
Like you don't have these kinds of debates when you set a ship to self-destruct. in any number of Star Trek episodes in which ships are going to be set to self-destruct, mm-hmm. no one stops to have a big court hearing about the sentience of the ship. but we do for Data. And again, I wonder, like, if it's just something because, like, as an audience, we feel that same thing. Like, is it because of the physical appearance of Data that we see him walking around? But when we do see that with Moriarty, at least in our visual cue, so, like, why do we feel so differently about Data and Moriarty, I guess, is... I mean, one reason is just straight up we're told to, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we, the episodes have a clear point of view about how we're supposed to, like, who we're supposed to be rooting for in this courtroom scene or in Picard versus Moriarty's logic battle. Like, we know who we're supposed to root for.
This is like this is not a, like, a good rationale, but I do think it's a rationale that has an impact. But the amount of time that we have spent with them, mm-hmm. I think, makes a big difference. Like, we've spent an entire season with Data, and the implication is that many of the other characters have spent years around Data and have developed this sense of who he is, and so a challenge to their perception of it, you know, is a challenge to our perception of Data. Whereas, like, well, the Moriarty thing's new, so maybe if we stop it soon enough, it doesn't feel the same. You know, yeah, if they had had continuing interactions with Moriarty, I think we would be suggested to feel differently as an audience.
Yeah, I think you're right. And, like, even just the opening that Geordi has some downtime and he wants to go hang out with his friend Data, you know, like, that says something about how these, you know, these characters that we've come to know, like, feel about their interpersonal relationships here. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's just the cue from that earlier episode that I think does feed into our overall perception of Data.
Yeah.
All right, Andrew, do you have any final thoughts about Measure of a Man or Elementary Dear Data?
I really do like Measure of a Man, and there's some moments of it that it deserves to be on many top 10 lists.
Yeah. And Elementary Dear Data is just fun. Like don't go in and try to pick apart, yeah. You know, the logic at the end. Go enjoy seeing Brent Spiner play an android playing Sherlock Holmes who realizes Moriarty is real.
Yeah,
it's, like, there's so many strange layers there, but it's not hard to follow, and it's great fun.
It's not among my favorite episodes, but it's not a bad episode by any mm-hmm. means. You know, I think I may have felt, like, more down on it overall. It's like, no, yeah. It is not a bad episode.
Yeah, and particularly for the early run of Star Trek: The Next Generation, I think it's a, mm-hmm. a pretty standout episode. All right, that's going to wrap up our discussion. Thank you for joining us. For show notes and links to all the other great Dueling Genre shows, you can go to duelinggenre.com. Also, please subscribe to the Protagonist Podcast in your podcast app of choice, and please leave us a review. That really helps us out. We would like to thank Scott Tuff, who composed our theme music. Thank you again for listening. We'll be back next week to discuss another great character and a great story. So long.
And we're good. Let's talk about
We'll get started.